Do you have no seance?
No, I had to put it up. Oh, okay. I'll talk loud. Try to anyway.
Excuse me. Everybody enjoy the coffee I made extra and we have less people.
You want to set up your fans somewhere?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad everybody made it here. In my ultimate optimism, I had a little space to write visitors down here, but are there any? But I'm glad each of you made the effort to get here. We were unsure this morning. We didn't get out yesterday, and the roads were all covered. And in our, those some of you have been to our house, but when you go out of our house, you go up a hill and down a hill, and they're the last two in the subdivision to get clear of ice and snow. So we thought, if we can get up and down our street, we're golden. And it was just wet. It wasn't any big deal. Fog was far worse of a problem than the ice and snow. So I appreciate all of you making the effort to get here and actually getting out and getting started to do that. Anybody have anything they want to talk about before we get started? I don't know, I feel like there may be something somebody wants to say. Anything? Okay.
I was going to tell a Kaylee story, but I'll wait on that same when they're more here.
Okay.
Well, you won't get it by then, will you?
You might have another Kaylee story about this. The Tales of Kaylee.
Yeah.
So, thanks, by the way, last week for allowing us to change the order of service a little bit. I don't know how that worked out. I know Don and I have talked about it, but I guess it gave us a time to get away and get back up and, you know, do appropriate honor to somebody we'd served with for a long time. And it was a good meeting, and I know a number of our people, Bill and Trevor were there, and the McClendons and the Dosses were there.
The Moores,
yeah, the Moores were there. Actually, all the Moores. The Moores and their son and his wife were there, too. So
you'll get to meet him because he's going to lead our bus trip.
Yeah, Stan is. In fact, he'll be here probably not this week or next week, but he'll be here in a couple of weeks. He's got his father has got Alzheimer's and is really bad, and he gets duty every 4 or 5 weeks, rotates among his sisters and kids.
I saw Stan this week at McDonald's, and I asked him when he was coming to visit with us.
Okay. Putting the pressure on him.
Yeah.
So he'll be here in a couple of weeks. So, but we can answer, you know, a lot of questions. He'll answer more questions about how the tour is and how it runs and whatever your questions are. He can answer that very well. So anyway, that'll be interesting. I'm glad we get to do that. Last week we started John 18 and didn't get finished with it. And we're going to pick up where we left off. I'll recap a minute. But I want to talk about two things before we get started. You can go ahead and turn to John 18 if you want. We haven't had a chance to talk about it. This sort of comes under the "in case you missed it" headline. But you know, we haven't talked much about the peace plan that was announced a couple of weeks ago. And I guess nobody knows exactly where that's going to go and how it's going to play out. But there's a couple of things prophecy watchers are always asking, because in the Bible it talks about in the middle of the tribulation period, there will be, or early in the tribulation period, there will be a confirmation of a peace treaty. And so anytime a peace treaty comes around, people are always saying, is this it, is that it? And I don't know the answer to that, I can't tell you. I don't sense that it's it now, it may be it later, because what happens, I believe, is a peace treaty, whatever it is, lays up on the table and doesn't really get ratified for a while, and then the Antichrist comes and does that. This peace treaty will be like that. It will lay on the table. The Arabs are not going to, you know, support the Palestinians for sure. And so it's going to sit there for a while. So we don't actually know that, but it's interesting. I want to just say also that that is a tribulation scenario. What we will see maybe is a peace treaty getting on the table early enough that we'll be able to see it before the rapture. Maybe this is it, maybe it isn't. But the actual signing of it and all that will come after we're gone. So that's a revelation. That's a thing that happens during the tribulation. The other thing I want to talk about is the coronavirus. I know that's on a lot of people's minds too. And I listened to a couple of people talk about this. And one of the things that's interesting, we always quote a verse in Luke, which is Luke's version of the Olivet Discourse, where he talks about, wars and rumors of wars, and there will be famine, and there will be pestilence in the land, and all that is one of the signs. But understand the Olivet Discourse is about the tribulation. It's not about what happens now. So when you read about it, much broader description in Matthew, but Luke and Mark also have little pieces on it. But it's also tribulation. So when they talk about these plagues, they're talking about plagues that happened during the tribulation time, not now. So most people think this is not that. It's not a harbinger of the beginning of the pestilence. But it is kind of a foreshadow, I think, in the sense that it gives us an idea how fast things can spread. You know, we've seen it before, and one of the commentators I listen to, he does a little video blog, and he said, you know, the Spanish flu back in the early 20s, I think, killed a million people and spread all over. But there was no airplanes. There was no instant travel. So it took a long time. They got it under control before it spread. We're not that lucky now. You know, it happens somewhere. It goes undetected for 2 weeks. And people are everywhere. They're on planes. They're on boats. They're on ships. They're back at home. You know, it's kind of a warning of pandemics to come. That's Luke 21, by the way, if you go read that verse that I talked about. So I don't think either one of these are harbingers. I think what they are is maybe a foreshadowing. So we see the angst for both of them. I mean, you know, you had people on the one side praising the peace deal. On the other side, you see them hating it. And then there's a bunch of people like the moderate Arabs in the middle who are not sure. They're kind of going to wait and see what happens. It's actually a pretty good plan if you look at it just from a business point of view. The problem, of course, is the Bible gives us strict instructions about not dividing the land of Israel. And those that divide the land of Israel will pay a price for it. And there's a book by a guy named Bill Koenig called Eye to Eye. And he lists all of the times that people have divided the land, both Old Testament, New Testament, and in today's world, and how what plagues have followed in their land. Kind of interesting. Pretty dry, but interesting book. So there's a lot of people, from a prophecy standpoint, are fearful of this because it may be a dividing of the land, and that may be something that brings, you know, bad karma, if you will, to America. I don't know that I go that far. I mean, I don't think anything's going to happen anyway, so I'm not sure I'm too worried about that right now. We'll be gone anyway, so right. I'm not that worried about it. But so any questions about any of those or anything else going on you want to talk about? I know there's something else in my mind, and I couldn't think of it when I was trying to think of what I was going to say on this. If I made it to church, what I was going to say on this topic today. Okay. Well, think about...
Supposedly signed a thing about putting prayer back in schools.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. And I think we're going to see, you know, all of the stuff that's being done now, all of the anti-abortion stuff, the pro-life stuff that's happening, is going to generate all of the... I don't know how to phrase the term, but all of the people that don't want that are going to be flushed out, and they're going to be standing tall and screaming and yelling and whatever. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see a time of a lot of anguish. Mm-hmm. But I do think we're getting close to the time. We're getting enough in the court, and I think the court's probably, for the right case, they would probably make a decision, you know, for pro-life. And I think we're not too far away from that, as long as, you know, it happens before the rapture occurs. Then we'll see some difference there. But that's a good point. I think all those things are going to flush out all the people that are haters of Christians and everything God stands for. Yeah, Bob.
You know, at one time when I was a lot younger, I used to say I didn't vote party. I voted for the best person. And now, as you read the platforms of the various parties, you really have to talk to your grandchildren and things about looking at what those the platforms are of the parties.
Right.
Because even if you have a very good person on the Democratic side, their platform does not back up Christianity.
No, it doesn't.
And so they almost have to vote with the party or they're going to be ostracized.
Yeah. Well, I think you see that all the moderate Democrats have been pretty much driven out. You know, pro-life Democrats, pro-marriage Democrats, pro-traditional anything Democrats are being driven away.
And our schools really are led by teachers. I'm generalizing a bit, but are more liberal than they are conservative.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, I don't know if you pay attention, some of you may, some of you don't, Bill does, but pay attention to what's going on in the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yes.
There's a lot of anguish now about the direction in which the convention is headed. And
we need to stay out of politics.
I would just say watch this space because, you know, what's going to happen is, you know, most of you know who Michael Youssef is at Church of the Apostles. Well, when the Episcopal Church went over the edge, he said, I'm no longer an Episcopal. I'm walking away, and I'm going to stand on the Bible. And I think a lot of churches are going to be forced to do that. They're going to be forced in the Methodist Church. They're going to be forced in a lot of churches to either go get on the slippery slope or get off of it and stand for the Lord. So, yeah, I think it's going to be real interesting the next few years to see kind of what happens.
And the danger there is as you raise your children and grandchildren in a conservative Baptist church, like we're blessed to go to.
Right.
Now, when those kids go away to college and get married and move all over the country, they'll look for a Baptist church, and it doesn't mean that that church is going to be conservative.
No, that's right. Yeah. In fact, you know, I'd say the chances are it won't be.
That's right.
Especially if it's in a big city. But, you know, God's in control, so we'll just kind of see what happens on that score and trust that he'll take care of it. Last week, let me get back to John here. Last week, we talked about the last part of the upper room, the walk over to Gethsemane, the prayer in the garden. We talked about how Jesus and his disciples had to cross, come down one side of the Kidron Valley, go up the other, and cross the brook in the middle. The brook would have been tainted with, or covered with, or filled with the blood from all the sacrifices. And, you know, it's not like they had a road to get in the car and drive over. They had to walk. Not a quick jaunt down because they had to come from behind. You know, the upper room is behind the Temple Mount, not on the Temple Mount. So they had to walk down the Kidron Valley and come up and then walk along the rim till they got to the Garden of Gethsemane. And if you go there, and many of you have been there, and you see that, you can... You know, it's hard to now look at it and not see the Gold Dome and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but, you know, the temple would have been where the Gold Dome is now. And so that's, you know, plays a pivotal role. And some of the gates to the city are still in the walls. So you can see the Sheep Gate and some of the other gates that are there. So if you know what you're looking for, you see still remnants of the temple area, even though not the temple itself is not there any longer. And so Jesus and his group went up into the Garden of Gethsemane, and they went into a private garden. I don't know how he got in, whether he had a key or he had, you know, maybe it wasn't locked, but it was a garden probably owned by one of the rich Jews that had been a secret follower of Jesus, but he'd used this all along. See, plenty of references to this where he had taken his disciples there as he... went back and forth to Bethany or when he needed to retreat for a little bit of time. So, you know, we understand that was part of it. So they were frequent visitors. Judas knew where it was. Judas brought, you know, the grand troop of 200 to 600 soldiers and everybody, as I mentioned last week. And so we remember all that. You know, they fall down. Peter cuts the ear off of one of the servants. All the disciples except Peter and John run away. They bind Jesus. They take him off. You know, the kiss of Judas. A lot of different events that we talked about. Go back and listen if you want to hear some more detail on that. He prayed for the cup to pass him by, but if it couldn't pass him by, then he was going to follow God's will. So I think we see, as one of you mentioned last week, a real demonstration of his humanity, even though he was God. He knew he was following God. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't going to, he still was interested if the cup could pass him by. And of course, that was never God's plan. And so he took the cup that God gave him, the cup of sorrow, the cup that, you know, he had given him, and he drank from that. And, and it was done. So let's go back to chapter 18, and we're going to pick up at verse 12, and we're going to finish this chapter today, God willing. And I'm going to read the chapter, and then I'm going to come back and talk about it, because reading the chapter gives you a flow of the events. Now understand, John didn't write every event down. He wrote the events that were not covered in some of the other Gospels, or wrote events that he wanted to cover in more detail than they did. So to get the full story, you have to do a get a parallel and kind of read what's going on in all of them. I'll bring some of it up, but verse 18 starts, "Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people." We talked about that earlier, and John had said, even though he didn't realize that, that was a prophecy that was fulfilled when Jesus died. Verse 15, we pick up anew here. This is for today. And it really starts to cover the denial. Simon Peter and another disciple were following him. I'll talk about the other disciple in a minute. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. "You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" she asked Peter. No, I am not. I am not. The weather was cold, and the servants and officials stood around the fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing there with them, warming himself. So you can kind of picture this scene as we come in. They're outside in the courtyard area. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. And you can go read in the other Gospels to understand what Jesus says here, and I'll come back and talk about it. Jesus says, "I've spoken openly to the world," he replied. "I always taught in the synagogues or at the temple, where all the Jews came together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face and said, "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. Jesus said, "If I said something wrong, testify as to what was wrong. If I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So he goes to Annas, has this little interlude, then he ends up going to Caiaphas. Meanwhile, out in the courtyard, Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself, so they ask him, who's the they? They are the servants and the officials that are out there warming themselves. They ask him, "You aren't one of his disciples too, are you?" And he denied it, saying, "I am not." One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him and said, "Didn't I see you with him in the garden?" Again, Peter denied it, and at that moment, a rooster began to crow. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they didn't enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we wouldn't have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Well, take him yourselves then and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," they objected. This took place to fulfill what Jesus had said about the kind of death he was going to die. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus replies, "Is that your own idea, or did others talk to you about me?" Pilate answers, "I am not a Jew. Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it you've done?" Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now, my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and come into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone who is on the side of truth listens to me." And then Pilate utters the famous phrase we always see, "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. With this, he went out again to the Jews, gathered there, and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him, but it's your custom for me to release one prisoner to you at the time of Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews? They shouted back, no, not him. Give us Barabbas. Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. And that sort of finishes this chapter. Kind of leaves you hanging a little bit. But I want to come back because there's so much to talk about here that needs a little further amplification. You understand the storyline. You understand what's happening. But picture from the garden, Jesus is being led off by however many hundreds there are. You know, bright night, full moon, Passover, full moon. But yet they have torches and, you know, swords and lanterns. And so Jesus is being led away, tied up, bound. And Peter and John follow in the distance. You hear that from one of the other the Gospels. And the rest of the disciples are nowhere to be seen. So they take him down. They follow the same track back. They go across the Kidron Valley, across the Kidron Brook, up through the Sheep Gate, and go, you know, in towards the temple. They walk back, go to where, Annas lives. And I'll talk about Annas and Caiaphas in a minute. And there's some question about where they live, although there's been some recent archaeology stuff over there where they believe they found the house of Caiaphas. And if you go there, we went on a tour a few years ago, and they took us down on the tunnel tour underneath the Western Wall. And at the end of the tunnel tour, where it begins to come back out, you're kind of beyond the thing over into the old city, you see magnificent houses that are being uncovered with Roman baths and all kinds of sculptured tile on them and inlaid floors. And they believe these were the houses of the high priest. So they're very close by. So they go to his house, and this starts. So they get to the gate, and what happens? So because this disciple was known to John the high priest, he went into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside. Well, this disciple has always been a question as to who this was. Almost everybody thinks that it's John the apostle. I mean, there are other people who say, oh, it was just somebody we don't know. Well, I mean, I don't think there's much evidence of that anywhere. I think it's John the apostle. John was very timid about writing by himself, about himself, you know, the disciple whom Jesus loved. The other disciple, he doesn't mention his name in his work. But he was known to the high priest, which is another subject we'll come back to. Peter wasn't, so he got to walk right in. They let him right through the gate, and Peter had to wait outside. And then John figured that out and went back to the gate and got Peter in. So Peter had to wait outside. So the arrest had taken place. Jesus is bound. Everybody's got him into the house. They take Jesus and however many people go with him up into the area where Annas is. John apparently goes up there too. But before that, he goes back and he gets Peter and lets him in. So let me set a little bit of a stage here. You know some of this, but Annas was the high priest from AD 6 to AD 15. He was named high priest. And he, under Jewish law, a high priest was named high priest for life. And he would have been the high priest for life, except the Romans, you know, I talked about before, they weren't into... term limits, so to speak. And when he'd been there 5 or 6 years, they deposed him. But he had enough power that what happened is his 4 or 5 sons and then his son-in-law all became the high priest. So now it's AD 33. His son-in-law, Caiaphas, is the high priest. He's already been through his sons. But to most Jews, especially the hierarchy, Annas is still the high priest, according to the Jewish law. And they follow him. They do what he says. He has power, still power, within the procedure. And I want to just tell you, remind you who he is. He's the guy that set up all the temple processes. He's the guy that set the money changers up in the temple. Remember, you come in and you had Galilean money. Well, that was no good. You had to change it for temple coins. And, of course, it was an exorbitant change rate for temple coins. And then you brought your own sheep, the best of your herds, but they weren't good enough. They weren't perfect enough, and so the screeners would say, "You can't bring that one. You buy one of our temple sheep." So Annas was the guy that had all the, you know, thinking of the, you know, the airport in Atlanta, he ran all the concessions, if you will. He had the money changer concession, he had the sheep concession, he had everything that had to make money around the temple, he was in charge of or owned. Annas was a rich man. He got rich every single year. So guess who was pretty ticked off at Jesus when he turned the money changers' tables over, and now the money was dirty, had to be picked up and then go washed. He preached against the religious Jews all the time. He created such a stir that they were afraid that the Romans were going to come crack down and take their power away. Annas was not a happy guy. And when they finally arrested Jesus, he'd sent the temple guard several times. When they finally got him, he wanted to see him first. So they brought him to Annas first. You know, Jesus is the one that says they turned his father's house into a den of thieves. So he didn't mince any words. It's kind of an interesting thing that Jesus' biggest criticism was for the religious leaders of the day. Not for the humble, not for the common man. If they sinned, he forgave them. But the religious leaders should have known better, and they didn't. And they willfully did what they did. So I think it's clear that John is the other disciple. And so the question is, well, he's just a Galilean fisherman. How was he known to the high priest? How did he get a free pass to get in and out of the gate and get in the house of Caiaphas? And the answer to that comes from Josephus, if you know who he is. He's a Roman historian who wrote really around 100 AD. John's father Zebedee, John and James were the sons of thunder, sons of Zebedee. He was a fisherman also, but he was also a salt fisherman. So what that meant was he not only caught fish out of the Sea of Galilee, but they salted them and they sold them because you had no preservatives. So he was a purveyor of fish. And one of the commentators says, so it's pretty interesting to think that John may have been the one who serviced the high priest's house and took the fish in and out. So he was well known as a frequent guest in and out of the house. Nobody thought a thing about him coming in. Now that's speculation, but it's speculation based on some understanding of who John's family was and what the connections they had with the hierarchy of the Jewish arena. It's kind of interesting, though, that John would become a disciple and throw all that away and stand strong for Jesus. It gives you an idea of the strength of John the Apostle. So that's kind of it. John comes back and speaks to the girl. You know, he's with me. She lets him in. The other disciple, I'm going to read this again, came back and spoke to the servant girl and there and brought Peter in. And then she asked Peter, "You aren't one." He replied, "I am not." So Peter denies the first time he comes into the courtyard. John returns back. He's not in this little group of people by the warming area. And Peter moves into the fire. It's closed. And I picture, you know, one of those fires like at a construction site where they have a, you know, big 55-gallon drum and everybody's standing there putting wood in it, standing
exactly
there trying to keep warm.
That's
the thing, you know, or a thing you'd put in your backyard that has flame in it. And so they're all getting there warm. Peter's there warming. And verse 19, meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and teaching. Now, one of the things you have to understand Jesus' response, is the law. And I'm going to give you a little bit of a law lesson here. The law, Annas wanted to gloat. He wanted to bring Jesus in and kind of tweak him a little bit because he had caused him so much trouble. And he begins right away to question him. But in the Jewish world, you could not question a prisoner and make him talk against himself. And we get that in our rule. We can plead the Fifth Amendment. It was even stronger there, though, because if you didn't have witnesses that corroborated the story and told the same story, you didn't have a case. And so you'll hear it here, and you hear it also in Caiaphas when we get there. They brought witnesses, and the witnesses all had different stories. So frustrated, what do? They turn to Jesus, and they begin to question him, which they're not supposed to do. And so when Jesus says, you know, he's questioning, Jesus says, "I've spoken openly. I always taught in the synagogues or the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? You know, you're not doing what you're supposed to do. Why are you questioning me?" Surely, ask those who heard me, surely they can tell you what I said. Well, of course, that was a slap in the face to Jesus because, you know, he basically called the hand of the high priest. And it's interesting that Jesus then says, well, okay, if I said something wrong, then you testify to what it is I have wrong. But if I spoke this truth, you shouldn't have struck me. It's easier to understand his response once we know what the law is and how they were doing it illegally. Second thing you need to know is trials like this were never held at night, never. They had to be held before the Sanhedrin. They couldn't be brought together in the dead of night, but yet they took him to Annas, then they took him to Caiaphas. You'll hear later they take him to Herod Antipas and they bring him to Pilate. So they go back and forth a couple of times, all of this happening before dawn, because they want to get him tried and convicted and sentenced so that the public knows nothing about what's happened. You know, the public liked Jesus. They admired Jesus. They followed Jesus. The hierarchy didn't, and they didn't want anybody to know. You know how in Congress sometimes they'll publish bad news on Friday night, or they'll publish it on a weekend when nobody's paying any attention? This is essentially what they're doing here. That's legal, by the way. This is illegal. They're doing it at night so that nobody knows what they're doing. And they called all of them together, which, again, they're not supposed to do. They're supposed to wait till daylight, because the Sanhedrin, if they pronounced a death sentence, one of the laws was if they pronounced a death sentence on anybody more than once every 6 or 7 years, they weren't doing their job, because it was very rare for them to do that. Not in this case. So Jesus calls their hand, and for that he gets slapped. You can just see, and I can see in my mind, all the yes men standing around the high priest. You know, he's got all the power. He's got all the money. Whatever he says, or if they think he's been offended, they step out and take control. And so Luke 22 adds a few details to this. And I'll pick up in Luke 22. You could read up, it starts in 54, but I'm going to read, I'll read at 54. Then seizing him, they led him away and took him to the house of the high priest. Peter followed in a distance, and when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down with them. Servant girl saw him seated at the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, this man was with him. He denied it. Woman, I don't know him. A little later, someone else saw him and said, you also are one of them. Man, I am not. Peter replied, man, I don't know what you're talking about. Just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken. So, I mean, picture this. It's a courtyard. So Jesus is in the house, probably upstairs in one of the rooms that's open. And Jesus is visible up there. Peter's not looking at him. Peter's down by the fire. But when the rooster crows, he turns around and looks up at the house. And Jesus turns around and looks at Peter. I mean, have you ever locked eyes with someone? I mean, you know, we try to make eye contact. But even, have you ever noticed, even an animal, if you lock eyes with an animal, they get real nervous. You know, dogs will get, sometimes they'll put their head down, sometimes they won't. Sometimes they'll think
start
you're...
growling.
Yeah, they'll start growling because they think you're, you know, coming at them. But I can't even imagine what went through Peter's mind when his eyes locked on Jesus' eyes and Jesus' eyes locked on his. I mean, I just think of that and I think horrible thoughts. Because Jesus had said to him, before the rooster crows today, you'll disown me 3 times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. So it's kind of interesting. You know, Peter remembers the words. He understands what he's done, even though it probably didn't occur to him until the rooster crowed. The rooster crowed, and now he got the slap in the face, so to speak, saw Jesus' eyes, and, you know, whether it was disappointment, whether it was, I told you so, I don't know what it was. But Peter was moved instantly. And so if we go back to John now, because I want to just have that little interlude there. So verse 28, I'll start at 25. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was staying there warming himself, so they asked him, you aren't one of the disciples too, are you? So you see a little bit of parallel. He says, I'm not. One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, we get that little bit here, challenged him saying, didn't I see you with him in the garden? Again, Peter denied it at that moment, and a rooster began to crow. So one of the things that's a you know, it's kind of like the question, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? You know, people ask kind of stupid questions sometimes. This whole theological point about a rooster is kind of that way. A couple of things you need to know. Roosters were not allowed in that part of the city. I don't know why, but I also don't know whether anybody paid attention to that. You know, we have a lot of rules that nobody pays any attention to. The other thing is, the Romans changed guard every few hours, and at 3 a.m., they had a trumpet blast, and it was called the cock crow. And so, was it a real rooster that crowed, or was it the trumpet by the Romans called the cock crow? I don't know. Either is okay with me. Again, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? But I would also say that there's no evidence in any of the things that indicate this is anything other than a natural event. You know, and all interpreters, I would say all, most interpreters of the Bible will say, if the thing makes plain sense and common sense, don't look for any other sense, or you'll be looking at nonsense. You know, so I think the plain sense is it's a rooster, and that's what I believe. Again, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but I think it was a rooster. But it is kind of interesting, because a rooster doesn't normally crow at 3 o'clock in the morning when it's dark. Yet, you know, I haven't seen anybody with a little remote that they press the button and the rooster crows. So roosters are kind of, you know, independent free thinkers on their crowing time. But, you know, if God wants a rooster to crow at a particular time, it's going to crow. I don't need to find an excuse for a miracle. It's just another miracle that God has figured out. So the rooster crows. Peter hears it. Peter is absolutely distraught. And you see later on in John where Christ restores him. And you'll kind of understand that when we get there. So back to John now. Hang on a minute. I think I'm still in... I think I'm back to John. By now it was early morning, and to avoid a ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace. See, Romans and Gentiles were unclean, and they were getting ready for Passover. And they had, if they got defiled, then they couldn't eat Passover because they had to do a bunch of steps to get ceremonially clean again. So the Jews brought Jesus. They were more than happy to send him in, but they didn't. They waited outside, and Pilate came out in the courtyard, so they wouldn't be defiled. And kind of interesting, you know, you miss big laws and little tiny ceremonial laws. You major on those, and that's what they were doing here. So Pilate came out to them and said, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" And you notice they don't answer that question. They say, "Well, if he wasn't a criminal, we wouldn't have handed him over to you." And Pilate says, well, Pilate's not stupid here. Pilate understands that something's going on here. This is a religious issue, not a legal issue. So Pilate says, take him yourself and judge him by your own law. And, you know, I'll make a pun here. There's no question this was a trumped-up charge. Kind of a good metaphor, isn't it? And, you know, so there was no evidence at all, but that doesn't stop them from bringing it because they want it to happen. And then they say, we have no right to execute anybody. The Romans had taken that right away from them. They hadn't stopped them, by the way, because they had executed a few people. But if they executed somebody, it had to be by stoning. That's the way they executed Stephen. There's a couple of others that were executed that way, by stoning. But usually that's a crime of passion. In the heat of the moment, they pick up rocks and stone somebody. Apparently nobody got really punished for that. But this was wide open. This was at Passover. This was the time when everyone would see. They didn't want to get involved in that. They objected, saying, we have no right to execute anyone. But this took place to fulfill what Jesus has said about the kind of death he was going to die. So again, if Jews had killed him, they would have stoned him. But if the Romans killed him, they killed him by crucifixion. And you remember the story we talked about earlier in John, where kind of a strange verse, where he quoted Moses and said, Moses is going to build a bronze snake, and he's going to hold it up, and you're going to follow that snake, that snake being held up, a snake has been lifted up for you to follow. Jesus also said that he's going to be lifted up when he's no longer here, he's going to be lifted up and draw all men to him. So Jesus knew he was going to be lifted up, and that meant he was going to be crucified on a Roman cross. So all of this happened not by accident, not by happenstance, but because the sovereign will of God had been pronounced, and it was going to happen exactly the way it was pronounced to do it. So Pilate then went back inside, summoned Jesus, and said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" I guess he'd heard that murmur that he was the king of the Jews, or claimed to be king of the Jews. And then Jesus answers him, "Well, is that your own idea, or did somebody tell you about me? You know, have you been told that by somebody, or is that what you think?" I mean, I think that's kind of an interesting question from Jesus to ask. And I guess he's trying to probe the mind of Pilate to get Pilate to perhaps come, you know, a little bit far out of the shadows. But that doesn't happen. Pilate says, "Am I a Jew? You know, am I a Jew? Your own people and chief priests hand you over to me. So what is it you've done?" And then Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world. But if it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders." But look at this next sentence. "But now, my kingdom is from another place." Underline "now" or circle "now," because later his kingdom will not be from another place. It'll be here on earth. So he's basically saying, this is not my kingdom yet, but there will be a kingdom to come. And that's kind of interesting. You know, there's no words that are throwaway words. There are words that have meaning, and this was one of them. And so Pilate seizes on that and says, you are a king then. And Jesus said, "You say I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me." Now, we know from earlier in John a couple of things. We know that God is truth. We know that Jesus is truth. We know his word is truth. We know that his word doesn't contain truth, it is truth. We know that he doesn't just speak truth, he is truth. So Jesus is basically saying, "I came to declare the truth myself, and all that are interested in the truth will follow me, will come to me, will listen to me." And of course Pilate doesn't get any of that, and he says, "Well, what is truth?" And we see that as a dramatic moment. It's really a pivot point for Pilate, because he's really dismissed Jesus at this point. He doesn't want to crucify him because he's looking for a way out, but yet he has no inner strength to do anything, no strength of his conviction. He could have right then said, "You're not guilty and I'm not going to execute you," but he didn't do that. I'll tell you why in a minute. So what is truth? People have asked that question throughout centuries. I mean, today, if you look at the world today, people want to define truth in their own ways. You know, my truth is relative. My truth is not your truth. Your truth is not my truth. If you believe this and I believe that, both can be true because we believe them and we're both sincere. Well, I mean, that's ridiculous. Something is true and something isn't true, but people don't want to do that. They don't want, you know, they want to believe what they want to believe. And we see it today in spades in the world.
They don't want to base it on the real truth.
They don't want to base it on the real truth. And I don't know, by the way, they don't want anybody telling them what's true. They want to, you know, they want to develop that on your own. So it's not a phenomenon to the Old Testament. It's a phenomenon, or the New Testament. It's a phenomenon here as well. So Pilate doesn't want to crucify him. He wants to free him. So he falls back on an old Passover tradition that they've had since the Romans took over. And he says, "But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of Passover. Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" The other principal to be looked at, though, is a guy named Barabbas. And his real name is Jesus Barabbas, or Yeshua Barabbas. And Barabbas means son of the father. It also can mean son of the rabbi or son of the leader. And so there's a lot of speculation that Barabbas was a rebel rouser for sure, but he may have also been the son of a prominent leader somewhere in Jerusalem. Nobody knows anything about him. There's not much about him in the Bible. But anyway, he had led a rebellion against Rome. He was a killer of Romans. He was a killer of Roman sympathizers. and he led a rebellion, and he got caught, and he got sentenced, and he got convicted. So there he is with Jesus, all of them getting ready for, you know, Roman punishment. And so Pilate says, basically, which one do you want? Do you want me to release the king of the Jews? Of course, they hated that term. You see that later. And they shouted back, no, not him. Give us Barabbas. And of course, you see that in all the plays. You know, give us Barabbas. And it's all part of an early morning gathering of people that the Jews had brought in. Most of the common public isn't even up and out yet. These are all people that they've brought in for this to be there and be their witnesses. You know how when you go to a court sometimes and there's people to speak against or for, some group will try to get all their supporters to go and stand against or for? That's what was happening here. The other side didn't even know this was happening, so it was kind of by default, but all the people had gone. So something else takes place before this too, which we don't see in this gospel. I'll just remind you of it. In the middle of this, before Pilate does this last little bit of judgment, he really doesn't want to pronounce judgment on Jesus. So he says it to himself, you're a Galilee. You're a Galilean. You're not a Judean from Jerusalem. I'm going to send you to Herod Antipas. Well, Herod Antipas was the tetrarch for that part of the land. But he was in Jerusalem for the Passover. So they sent him to Herod's house. And you can go read this in the other Gospels. And Herod was amused by him, brought him in, wanted him to either pay him some money or wanted him to perform a miracle for him. Kind of like, you know, okay, your organ grinder's crying, you know, do a trick for me and I may release you. Jesus wouldn't do any of that. In fact, didn't say anything. And so they send him back. And Pilate has no choice now but to pronounce judgment. So you see kind of a little bit that was left out of John's gospel, because John doesn't write everything that's in the other gospels. He just wrote things they didn't. So all of that happens. It all happens before dawn. It's now getting very early in the morning, and they bring him out. Pilate stands in the front of his house in the judgment area, and he offers them a choice, and they don't take it. So Jesus is the one that he turns. And we know what happens is he says, okay, take him away, and they begin to flog him, and they do, we'll talk about this next week, everything they do to him on the way to the cross. But I want to just kind of talk about a couple of things that are important as we look at this. So this whole process was illegal. The Sanhedrin, which is supposed to be the highest court in the land, and these officers of the Sanhedrin and these priests were the officers of the court. And everything they did here was illegal. Not only doing it at night, but doing it without witness. They never had a single witness that was corroborating. So they used him as a witness, which was illegal, but they asked him a question and he confirmed, you know, that he was the Messiah. I think when Caiaphas was questioning him and he, you know, tore his clothes and said, oh my gosh, do we need any more witnesses? Well, they didn't have any witnesses. All they had was Jesus, and that was illegal for them to ask him that, but that didn't matter. So really a kangaroo court, if you want to go by it. And then early in the morning, they get him out before everybody's up, and they pronounce judgment. Because once it's underway and the Romans have pronounced judgment, then judgment's going to happen. And so they pronounce judgment, and they begin to carry him away. The die is cast. The Jews can squall all they want, and nothing's going to happen. It's going to take place the way they had it set. The other thing is, this was God's will. You know, for many years in the church, they blamed the Jews for crucifying Jesus. And they did. But all of it was God's will. This was all in the plan. It was all prophesied. Everything about it was prophesied. How it would happen, when it would happen, how he would be killed, what would happen in the grave, what would happen when he resurrected. All of it was part of the prophetic understanding of both Christ and God. So it's hard to fault somebody for doing what God has led them to do, even though it was the wrong thing. Because they really were supposed to be God's witnesses here on earth, and they turned out not to do that at all. You know, they became really his enemy, and we see that all through the Old Testament. This is just the last straw for this, the final chance, and they don't do it. Even the ones who were closet supporters of his, you know, Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea. None of them stepped forward. None of them said a word. Just happened.
Jim, he still uses sinners today.
He does. And we shouldn't be surprised by that. You know, God's in control. He was in control here. This was not, they didn't lead him involuntarily. This was the plan that happened. Any questions or comments? Any thoughts about this?
Two things. You talk about all of those events being illegal. Do you think that that was very unusual for them to be so illegal, so to speak, during that time?
I think it probably was. I think their hatred so blinded them that they were not going to risk doing this in public where it wouldn't happen. They did it in the dark, so to speak, when they could do whatever they wanted and nobody would see them. You know, evil flourishes in the dark. The sunshine is a great disinfectant for it.
Yeah.
They didn't want sunshine. They wanted dark.
So I
think this was unusual for them.
That's what I was thinking.
But it does tell you their nature.
Yeah.
Their nature is, hey, this is going to happen. We're going to make it happen one way or the other, regardless of what rules and law and everything else we have to break.
And that thought continues today.
Oh, it's rampant in society. I mean, you know, closer than that to us.
My other question, if I remember right, when they were taking Jesus back up to the mount, the gate, the sheep gate, isn't that the gate that's sealed right now?
No, not the sheep gate.
Eastern gate.
And that was sealed by the Muslims, by the way, at about 600 A.D. because they read the prophecies that Jesus was coming back. Mm-hmm. And so they did two things. They sealed the gate up because that's where he's supposed to come through. And they buried all their dead on that side of the mountain because they didn't think, as a man of God, he would walk over their dead.
They think that'll stop him.
Yeah, and Bill and I had an interesting conversation. We were on our last tour over there, and the guide was an Arab guide. And he said, yeah, he said it was pretty ingenious what they did. Mm. And I said, have you read Zechariah 13, whatever it is? He said, no. Mm. And so we read it to him.
Yeah.
And what it says is when Jesus comes back and he sets foot on the mountain splits, and the valley splits, and he walks right up and goes right through the gate.
Praise God.
And, you know, so whatever they do doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, all that is just in the wind. It
what
just
was
doesn't...
the guide's response?
Oh, he was stunned, wasn't he?
He
had nothing to say.
Maybe he went home and studied.
Yeah, he I'm sure.
I think
I'm sure.
He was so knowledgeable, factual about everything, but it wasn't in his heart.
No.
And we went back a second time to Jerusalem with a believer as a guide. Huh. And it was all the difference.
It makes all the difference in the world, I think.
But this guy was really smart.
He was good.
He
was a nice guy.
But he didn't believe in
him. He was a nice guy, but it just worked out well for that to be said to him at that
time. It did. And whether that made any effect on him long term, I don't know.
Peter was a nice guy.
With all the prophecy, and the Jewish people and leaders, all these years have been studying all this prophecy, and they couldn't see all this happening in front of them?
Well, see, I don't want to get off the prophecy, but prophecy has something called a mountain peaks deal. You can see a prophecy and read it, and it has an application nearby, but it also has a secondary application in the future. And they never looked for that. They didn't want that. They thought Jesus was going to come back as the Lion of Judah and throw off the chains to the Romans. They missed the whole part about him coming back as the Lamb of God. It's there, but they missed it. They still don't read Isaiah 53. You won't find that read in the synagogue today. They don't read it. Mm. Why? Pretty obvious if you read it. But they don't read it. So, yeah, I think it's that way. Other questions? I know we're getting close on time. Still got 3 minutes. All right, let's have a prayer, and then we'll dismiss. Lord, we're just thankful that everyone got here today and got here safely. We pray for the pastor as he comes to teach and talk to us today. We pray that you've given him a powerful sermon that he will just lay out in the Spirit's power to us, and that it'll have great effect on us, meet us where we need it the most. Lord, I pray for our families here, all the prayer requests that we have. I just lift everyone up to you and their families, those that couldn't make it. I just pray for them to be safe and secure and wait for this bad weather to pass. Lord, I just ask all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all.